It is Wednesday, August 14th, 2013, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Kyle Kellum. Support for Ozarks at Large comes in part from the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle. The Fort Smith Symphony's 90th anniversary season presents six concerts of classical and popular music featuring an international lineup of guest artists. Tickets and more information are available at 452-7575 or fortsmithsymphony.org. Season tickets to this celebratory season are now available.
Ahead on the show, if you have a child anxious about attending a new school in a few days, we have three things that can help you ease a child into a new school year. Lynn Webb, a professor of communications at the University of Arkansas, explains how skills that help reduce anxiety about school can be used the rest of your life.
Plus, the desire for a new fish hatchery in Northwest Arkansas. And Zeke Taylor explains why painting a simple black cat is harder than you might think. He's the featured artist at the Norberta Philbrook Gallery in Bentonville for a new show opening tomorrow.
But first, a spokesman for the Arkansas Secretary of State says the office should be allowed to use outside counsel in a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit rather than relying on representation from the Attorney General. Alex Reed with the Secretary of State's office says Pulaski County Judge Tim Fox's ruling did not take into account that constitutional officers, state agencies, boards, and commissions have used private lawyers in the past.
We feel like the judge misapplied the law. And we're in the process right now filing an appeal to the state Supreme Court. We're hoping to have it filed this week. The earlier this week, the better. And once we get that filed, then we'll just wait on a hearing from them.
Reed says the decision has nothing to do with the relationship between the Secretary of State and AG offices. He says they would just prefer outside counsel in this matter.
Damage assessment continues in Benton County following recent floods that damaged roads and bridges. Robert McGowan is director of Benton County's Emergency Management Department.
We're still in the process of documenting additional flooding for some county roads that hadn't been previously reported that we found yesterday. As we're out assessing the damage, we have found several additional roads that nobody had reported in or we haven't been on, and we're still processing and collecting that data.
He estimates that assessment is about 90% complete, but can't say for sure. So far, the total cost of damage is around $5 million, but the county may not have to pay all of that if state and federal officials provide disaster aid to the county.
Hopefully by the end of the day today, I will submit the numbers to the Arkansas Department of Emergency Management. They will send somebody up to do assessments to see if they agree with our numbers. If they agree with the numbers that we have submitted, then they will request to FEMA Region 6, a federal disaster declaration. If then FEMA sends representatives in, they check our numbers, and if they agree with them, then they either recommend or not to the president that he either sign or not sign off on the disaster, and at that point, it's up to him.
If the state agrees to send aid to Benton County, it could cover up to 35% of repair costs, while FEMA funds could cover about 75% of the costs. McGowan says much of the damage from this most recent round of flooding occurred along the northern edge of the county. Parts of Benton County saw as much as 20 inches of rain during the past month.
Meanwhile, in Newton County, the recent rains have provided a rare opportunity for boaters on the Upper Buffalo River. Mike Mills, who operates the Buffalo Outdoor Center in Ponca, says much of the year has actually received average rainfall, though temperatures have been slightly cooler on the river. But the recent rains have been somewhat peculiar.
August, of course, is extremely unusual. I've been in business 40 years. This is only the second time in 40 years that the Upper Buffalo has been floatable, and the last time it was only floatable for one day. Never in my recollection has the water been over the bridge at the Ponca Low Water Bridge, and it's now been over it twice this week.
Mills says while this year has been a rather good year for business, years of plenty don't necessarily make up for prior years of drought.
It's nice to get a little extra, but last year was last year. The bank payments and insurance payments and advertising payments were all there, and you had to make those no matter what you did. It's easier to do when you're having a really, really good year. Obviously, the business profit is up when you're having a really, really good year. So, you know, each year is different, and that's one of the things you learn real quick in the outdoor recreation industry is that each year is going to be different.
As of this morning, the U.S. Geological Service monitoring station at Ponca recorded the Buffalo River at 3.9 feet. Further downriver near St. Joe, the river level was recorded at almost 9 feet.
Unofficial results from yesterday's special elections are in, and a runoff will be held September 2nd in Springdale to determine who takes over the Ward 4 Position 1 seat on Springdale City Council. Candidates Rick Culver and Mike Lawson each received 333 votes, while Mitch Miller received 112. Further south in Logan County, the special election in Paris decided the city will levy a 1% sales tax to eliminate sanitation fees for residents and to pay for water and sewer upgrades. Mayor Dennis Rogers says the tax is expected to net the city around $500,000 annually. Final vote there, 223 for the tax, just 39 dissenting votes cast. And 24% of registered voters in the Madison County seat of Huntsville turned out for the special citywide bond election yesterday. Six issues were up for consideration, and the questions regarding street, water, sewer, fire department, and park improvements each passed, some with margins as high as 50 votes. The one issue that did fail was the question of funding of a museum and visitor center to be located in Huntsville. It failed by a margin of 7 votes. A total of 257 people voted in that city's election yesterday.
Mercy Hospital has announced the opening of 3 new primary care clinics in the River Valley area. Mercy Convenient Care Zero Street is the second walk-in location for Mercy in Fort Smith. Mercy McCauley Family Medicine has opened on 74th Street, also in Fort Smith, and it is reportedly targeted toward providing health care for Medicaid patients seeking a primary care provider. And Mercy has also opened Mercy Clinic Primary Care, Salisaw, on Choctaw Avenue, which is the first Mercy Clinic Fort Smith location to be located on the Oklahoma side of the border.
Merchandising for licensed college merchandise is big business. According to Collegiate Licensing Company, an affiliate of IMG College, the retail marketplace for college licensed merchandise in 2012 was estimated at $4.6 billion, and the first time since it became a CLC partner institution in 1988, the University of Arkansas has broken into the top 10 in CLC's fiscal year-end rankings. Arkansas jumped 4 places to end the year at 10th place, and for the 8th consecutive year, the University of Texas in Austin topped that list. The Northwest Arkansas Naturals had a victorious return to Arvest Ballpark last night in Springdale. Nats defeated Corpus Christi 10-1. The 3-game series continues tonight in Springdale.
Tonight, mostly clear with lows from 54 in northwest Arkansas to 60 in the Arkansas River Valley. Mostly sunny tomorrow with highs from 79 in northwest Arkansas to 80 in the Arkansas River Valley. Partly cloudy tomorrow night with lows from 56 in northwest Arkansas to 63 in the Arkansas River Valley. This is Ozarks at Large. The plans for a fish hatchery in Centerton began in the middle of the Great Depression, long before large man-made lakes were part of the landscape in northern Arkansas. The now-named Charlie Craig State Fish Hatchery has been part of Benton County for years, and as Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis reports, there are basic plans to make an upgrade sometime in the future.
The C.B. Craig Fish Hatchery has been a fixture in Centerton for about 7 decades. Tommy Laird is the manager of the hatchery for the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission. He says that while the hatchery has served the Game and Fish Commission's purposes well for that time, recent years have brought new constraints to operating the hatchery.
Well, the hatchery at the Centerton location was built in the late 30s, and it was built with the main water supply being a spring. Well, in the late 1990s, like 95, 96, we've noticed a drastic reduction in the amount of water we get out of that spring. The spring used to produce around 1,700 gallons a minute, and now it's only producing, on average, about 400 gallons a minute with seasonal lows of around 200. Now, while that sounds like a lot of water to most people, when you're dealing with millions and millions of gallons of water for ponds, it's not.
Laird says that the Game and Fish Commission has tried different ways of getting more water into the hatchery. Recirculating water between ponds helps cut the demand for the millions of gallons of water necessary for the hatchery to operate, and Game and Fish officials even drilled a well more than 1,700 feet deep to the aquifer, a well that can produce about 260 gallons per minute, But Laird says that the depth of the well makes it cost prohibitive to be used as a primary water source, as it would cost between $5,000 and $6,000 monthly to constantly pump from the well. Those reasons are why Laird says that he and other game and fish officials have been working for about a decade toward building a new hatchery to replace the old one in Centerton. Though there are several sites under consideration, Laird says that the most palatable proposal is building a new hatchery adjacent to the Northwest Arkansas Conservation Authority treatment plant near Highville.
Altogether, I have probably looked at 40-plus sites, but we had five or six that what I would call viable sites, you know, that met our criteria or most of our criteria. But all of them have some kind of disadvantage. You know, some of them were privately owned and we'd have to purchase. The one thing about the NACA property is if we can enter an agreement with NACA, there would be no cost to us whatsoever. It'd be a long-time lease agreement.
George Spence is Bentonville's city attorney, and he's the chairman of the Conservation Authority Board. He says that the authority would be required by law to lease the land rather than sell it to the Game and Fish Commission.
It's just part of the property, and the bonds under which we purchased all of this property and set this up have restrictions on what we can do with the property. And that's one of the things we'd have to do is make sure that this would not affect that in any way.
Spence says that any plans to build a hatchery on Conservation Authority land couldn't impact operations of the treatment plant, hamper future expansion of the plant, or negatively impact the authority's ratepayers, which only includes Bentonville and Tontytown at the time being. Yet, he says that there are a few hurdles to overcome before officials can commit to building a hatchery on the site.
The two obstacles to this at this time are, one, to overcome the technical issue of whether or not, one, they can use the cleaned water that we produce for the fish hatchery, and two, the other technical side of it is, when that water comes out of the fish hatchery and goes back into NACA, does that cause any problems, and how do we deal with that? And then in addition to just figuring that side of it out, which I think everybody thinks will probably work, it's just a matter of figuring out how to make it work. The other question is getting enough money to build it. I mean, that's the question on anything like this.
As for the technical issues, Laird says that using effluent from the treatment plant is only one option being considered to make it more of a green hatchery.
But we may also use water from the Little Osage. At this time, we don't know. That's just, there's too many variables. And I mean, we're looking at pharmaceutical drugs and how long-term use could affect the fish. But like I said, at this time, it's not been finalized.
Laird says that the main obstacle to overcome in building a new hatchery on the Northwest Arkansas Conservation Authority land or elsewhere is the issue of money.
And that's one reason nothing's been done in the last 2 years. It's just a big project. It's going to take a lot of funds, and money hasn't been appropriated yet for anything. That's why we're just in the very preliminary stages of this. We're still trying to find a site. All the other factors haven't been thought out yet.
As for the Conservation Authority chipping in on the cost, George Spence says that it wouldn't be a possibility, as any cost to the Conservation Authority would increase the cost to its ratepayers. Laird says that while the Game and Fish Commission wants to build a new hatchery in Northwest Arkansas to maintain its footprint in the area, the best case scenario would see a new hatchery built in 5 to 6 years at the earliest. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
Doctors treating a 12-year-old Arkansas girl who contracted a rare brain-eating parasite while playing at a water park say she was able to be taken off a ventilator last week and has made remarkable progress given the odds. Karen Trico-Stewart from our content partner KUAR checked on the young woman's updated condition earlier this month, and she has this story about her and the doctors who've been working with her since she contracted the infection.
The mortality rate for patients with primary amoebic meningoencephalitis, or PAM, is very high at 98 to 99%. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, of the 128 known cases in the United States since 1962, only one patient has survived, and there is also one documented survivor in Mexico. That makes Callie Hardig's recovery pretty rare. Dr. Mark Hewlett at Arkansas Children's Hospital is part of her care team.
She is now breathing on her own. She is no longer on any oxygen. She is off of the medicines we were giving her to induce her coma, and she has woken up some. She is responding to some questions. She cannot speak right now because her throat is so sore, but she is making head nods and thumbs up signs in response to questions.
Dr. Hewlett says her throat is so sore because the tube that was placed in it while she was on a breathing machine for 2 weeks caused swelling in her vocal cords, making it difficult to speak. The next step for her is rehabilitation, which Hewlett says will likely take anywhere from 4 to 6 weeks.
It's going to be a while for her brain to completely recover from this. We still do not know how much will recover, but the fact that she's able to answer questions and respond to things is a very good prognostic sign for her.
Dr. Hewlett says the disease is caused by a type of amoeba that lives in warm water, and it's more common in southern states since lakes and ponds get warmer in our region.
When you go swimming into a lake or a pond, and you kick up the dirt, that dirt will then kick up these organisms and they'll get into the water.
The organism can then enter the nose and come up into the brain through an area called the cribriform plate.
It invades into the brain and the brain swells, and then the swelling becomes so severe that we can't control it.
But Dr. Hewlett says it's important to note that the disease is very rare.
Millions of people swim in lakes every day, and they don't get this. There's only 128 reported cases, so it's extremely rare. We do not know why certain types of patients get it and others don't.
Hewlett says it may be that the cribriform plate in some people has a defect, allowing the parasite to more easily spread into the brain. Dr. Mubashir Ahmed, who's also part of Callie Hardig's care team at Arkansas Children's Hospital, says he thinks it was a quick and accurate diagnosis and very aggressive treatment that helped her recover. Also, the use of the latest available drugs, including a cancer drug from Europe not currently approved in the United States, that the hospital obtained through the CDC.
I think those factors are kind of what led to her potentially having a different outcome than the other patients.
Callie Hardig came to the ER with severe headaches and neck pain. Dr. Ahmed says it's a more tricky infection to diagnose because when patients come in, doctors often think it's bacterial meningitis.
And amoebic meningitis or meningoencephalitis tends to be lower on the scale just because it's so rare.
Ahmed and his colleagues continue to enter uncharted territory in this case, and Callie's survival will be used to dictate where things go.
Because it's so rare, there is no guideline to follow, and you kind of go off on how she's doing, how the brain swelling is doing. I think we just look at the overall picture rather than have some algorithm that's been set out from previous cases.
As far as taking measures to try to prevent getting the disease, Dr. Jennifer Cope with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says,
the only 100% sure way to avoid this or prevent this infection is to avoid swimming in warm freshwater lakes, ponds, and rivers. But we realize that's not something, you know, we don't want to discourage swimming. Swimming's a healthy and fun activity.
But Dr. Cope says there are some measures people can take to help reduce their risk.
And those include holding your nose shut, using nose clips, or just keeping your head above the water when you take part in water-related activities in warm, fresh water. Also, avoid putting your head under the water in hot springs and other untreated thermal waters. Avoid water-related activities in warm freshwater during periods of high water temperature and low water levels.
Cope also recommends trying to avoid digging in or stirring up the sediment in shallow freshwater areas. And then there's the issue of nasal irrigators, known as neti pots. They look like little teapots, and many people use them to rinse the nasal cavities to help with allergies, sinus problems, and colds. There were two cases in Louisiana in 2011 where neti pots were used with water that was not sterile, and it led to the fatal infection.
We don't think that people should just stop using them altogether, but we do want people to understand that tap water is not sterile, and so when you're using tap water in sensitive areas of the body like the nasal cavity, that you should consider what your water source is. And so we recommend that you use water that's either been previously boiled and then left to cool, or water that's been filtered using a filter that specifies that it's an absolute pore size of 1 micron or smaller.
Orcope says buy water with a label that specifies that it is distilled or sterile. As for Callie Hardig's future, Dr. Hewlett remains optimistic.
The fact that we've gotten to the point where the swelling has been reversed and she's showing signs of improvement shows that she most likely will survive this and do very well.
Since Willow Springs Water Park in Little Rock is the most likely source of Hardig's infection, and another case of the same rare parasite was reported there in 2010, the Arkansas Department of Health has asked the owner to close the water park to ensure the health and safety of the public.
Karen Trico-Stewart from our content partner KUAR filed that story from Little Rock for Ozarks at Large. This is Ozarks at Large. And ahead on the program, Zeke Taylor is known for his artwork that includes animals, often chimps.
The first chimp painting I did was an assignment for a decorator pillow company that was carrying my work nationwide, and they would use my designs on the pillow tops. And they wanted a clothed chimp, and it was so much fun and got such great response that I continued to do those.
Zeke Taylor talks about his art and being asked to be the featured artist at the Norberta Philbrook Gallery in downtown Bentonville for tomorrow's Around the Block, ahead on Ozarks at Large.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, American utilities are scrambling to slow the growth of solar and other renewable energy sources. Are they wasting their time?
By the end of this decade, wind and solar are going to be the cheapest way to generate power in about 75% of the world, and that includes us. That includes the developed world.
That story next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now, this afternoon at 1 on KUAF 91.3 FM.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is our history doctor, Bill Smith. Welcome back.
Good to be here.
I want to talk to you today about the attack on the American ambassador and the consulate in Benghazi, Libya. We've had investigations, blue ribbon panels. And, Bill, I want you to help us now sort through the news from Benghazi, and let's add some historic perspective.
Not to diminish the questions that have been raised, but this is not unique in our history. We can say the frequency of these attacks on diplomats and American interests abroad perhaps have increased during the latter 20th and now 21st century as the United States becomes a global power. But unfortunately, we've been here before.
There has been talk of conspiracy and cover-up, the effort to make some political gains in parsing who or what is actually responsible for that attack in Benghazi.
Well, and to quote the former Secretary of State, what difference does it make with four Americans dead? The answers are right in front of us. Ultimately, the president is responsible, and in regard to diplomatic missions, the Secretary of State.
That doesn't necessarily satisfy many of the people who are creating the investigations, though.
No, and it shouldn't.
Well, so it seems that you agree with some of the points made by General Issa and the whistleblowers?
Well, actually, I see them continuing the timeless political party battle of our American system.
Well, you can't have it both ways. Or are you about to give me some political facts, some history to prove this?
Well, the history in Americans' foreign policy tragedies reveals several through lines that are politically agnostic. It doesn't matter if it was the elephant or the donkey who was in charge, especially the bull moose.
Okay, elephant, donkey, Republicans, Democrats, bull moose would be Teddy Roosevelt?
Yes. With Theodore Roosevelt's administration, we see the beginning of a more globally aggressive foreign policy and one directed by the chief executive. It was Teddy who famously admitted after his presidency, quote, "I took the canal zone and let Congress debate. And while the debate goes on, the canal does also." The more the United States has a need for resources, markets, and power to enforce its will, the more we will run into opposition around the world.
And that gets us to Benghazi?
And Khobar Towers, and Lebanon, and Tehran, and the Mayaguez.
So this becomes an unfortunate byproduct of inevitable conflict between American interests and interests of other nations?
Yes, and to that extent, as the world continues to have conflicting global powers, this will be a part of our present and then our history. Let's not forget a critical issue that led to the foundation of this nation. It was Great Britain's need to deal with paying for and policing a frontier clash, the French and Indian War, that escalated from there. The mid-1700s aren't exactly a time frame that people consider global economies, but how could we think that we were going to retreat from the world today when we were founded in such a set of circumstances in the colonial era?
So what else would you say is consistent in this recent series of events?
Well, the foreign part of it is straightforward, American interest versus foreign interest. The domestic part should maybe concern more people.
The political infighting, that might distract us from the larger questions?
Well, actually, no. The truly bothersome consistency is that active campaigns of deception, cover-up, and misdirection carried on against the American public by the executive branch.
What now? Say what?
The one thing that we can say today with full assurance of truth is that the outside of the inner sanctum of the executive branch didn't really know what happened. And we won't know for years, perhaps decades to come, of what really happened. Let me reach back to a couple of foreign policy events that were either covered up or downplayed in the moment to explain where I'm going with this. Not unlike the current situation, the first has an Arkansas tie through J. William Fulbright.
The Gulf of Tonkin?
Precisely. The attack on American naval forces by the North Vietnamese Navy became justification for the expansion of military operations in Southeast Asia under President Lyndon Johnson. He asked his former Senate colleague, J. William Fulbright, to shepherd the resolution authorizing the president to use increased force in Vietnam through the Congress. Within a few years, it was revealed that what had been portrayed to be was not quite what it was. Yet even in the late 1960s, when what we today would call whistleblowers stepped forward to blow holes in the official government version of events, military and executive branches steadfastly denied that anything had gone wrong. Today, we know those events were the classic fog of war misadventures that then were used for political purpose.
And then you had Fulbright, former Senate colleague, fellow Democrat of the president, becoming a key opponent to Johnson's policies.
True. When his staff received the first reports that they were misled, Fulbright quickly became a staunch opponent of the war and the resolution.
All right, you said you had another.
Well, this was the bombing of the international sector of Shanghai, China, later the sinking of four U.S. ships in the Yangtze River near Nanking in 1937 by elements of the Imperial Japanese Navy. The most famous of these, the USS Panay, that's a United States naval ship, which was anchored at the besieged city. The Japanese sank the Panay and three U.S. oil tankers owned by Standard Oil. In attempting to avoid a remember the Maine event that would push the United States perhaps into war or at least into greater involvement in the conflict that was existing between China and Japan.
A no-win situation at that point.
Absolutely. Franklin D. Roosevelt's State Department accepted the imperial government's explanation of an accidental bombing of the ships and the diplomats. Later investigations revealed that the U.S. Navy at the time had evidence of the targeting of the Panay. It was clearly marked with American flags and a large flag on deck, so any aircraft diving in to bomb would have easily been able to avoid that that was an American ship. And Japanese sources would confirm the deliberate targeting of foreigners as a way to remove them as political allies for the Chinese.
So we can see a rather grim trend here.
This isn't a lighthearted subject. But regardless of president or time period, there is an unfortunate but reasonably consistent trend of deception, cast as well-meaning or attempting to avoid further conflict, about the circumstances these events cause when we look at them in real time. One thing we can see as a change with a more interconnected society, those who seek to reveal the details left out by the original counts have a more robust means for getting the word out.
So until, as Jack Nicholson reminds us, we can't handle the truth,
we're history.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And we begin a new series on Ozarks with today's program.
We do. We like our series around here.
We do. We do indeed. This one is designed to ask people who know more about things than we do about those things.
Yes, we're asking people to tell us three things that we should know about a specific subject.
Because here's the deal. There's a lot of information out there.
So much.
So much. But there are basic things we should know either about the economy, about the environment, and today, somewhat about education.
Okay.
School years are starting this week and next week for just about everybody that's in grades K through 12 in Arkansas in our listening area. Sometimes you're going to a new school, and sometimes that can be intimidating. So I decided to ask Lynn Webb, who is a professor of communications at the University of Arkansas, about three things that can help ease the transition into a new school for students.
I think the young people, especially if they're transitioning from one school to another, like from elementary school to middle school or middle school to high school, they're not sure what to expect, and usually we have more stress around the unknown than we do the known. So there's that, and parents, of course, every year, if you're a parent, as I've been, you're running around trying to get your kids ready, school supplies, new clothes, just learning where to drive if it's a new school, how I get there, and that sort of thing.
All right, so let's talk about three things that can help this be a little bit easier. What is something that parents can do, or guardians, or aunts, or uncles, or maybe even big brothers or big sisters, to help make this less stressful?
Okay, the first thing is to help people maintain a sense of normalcy. And that's often what makes people nervous or puts them under stress or in crisis, is when they think something abnormal is occurring. So if instead you emphasize with your children the normalcy of this, that will help them. So, for example, you could say, well, all summer we would get up, have breakfast, and then you got to go out and play with your friends, and then you'd come back home for supper. Well, it's going to be the same. You're going to get up and get dressed. You'll just go to school. And then when you come home, the family will have supper like we always do. So you stress the parts of the day that will be similar and give them that sense of normalcy, that things will remain normal. The essential things will remain normal.
I like that. Now, if you've been able to sleep in till 10:30 or 11, you realize that that won't be normal. That won't be the case when school starts.
Right. And that's fine, too, because you just say to them, well, you'll still get those days when you sleep in. It'll just be on the weekend. So, again, you take whatever seems normal to them or what they're concerned about losing, and you explain to them how they get to maintain it or maintain it in a different form or at a different time. Like, another thing children often say is, I won't ever get to see my friends. And you can say, oh, yes, you will. You'll see your friends. And then just go through it with them. You know, you have all those friends you play soccer with. Well, now you'll see them twice a week at soccer practice. And so on, and go through, like, you'll see your friends at Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts or Sunday school or whatever their now activities will be now that school has begun.
All right, so stress, normalcy, stress this sort of the things that remain permanent. What's a second thing you can do?
A second thing to do is walk them through their day. Like, my husband's an attorney, so we used to say to our kids every morning, let's go over what's on the docket for today. But you don't have to call it a docket. You can call it just the agenda or what's going to happen today. And every morning, if they can have a sense of what was going to happen, that will help them. Now, when they're moving from their summer program type of life to a school life, often their stress surrounds the unknown, the ambiguity, like what will happen, what will happen when. So if you can, as a parent or an older brother or sister, just say, now we'll probably get up around 6:30, and then we'll get washed and dressed, and then we'll have breakfast, then we're going to walk to the bus stop, then we're going to get on the bus, like whatever it is, go through this to this to this to this, and put all the steps in, even if it's 20 or 30 steps, because then the child can picture in their mind, like a story, what is going to happen. And so they already feel familiar with it when it happens. They can anticipate. All that fear of the unknown is removed. They can anticipate it's going to happen, and when they walk through it, it'll seem fine to them because it's what they expect.
Is it better for that to be an audio component rather than, say, a schedule on a whiteboard or on a refrigerator?
Both are fine. Children have different styles of learning. I had a child, one of my three children had a visual impairment, and no amount of talking to him helped. I always had to go to the school ahead of time. Even if it was a school he went to last year, it seemed to really help him if we would go to the school and just walk through, like, oh, look, you know, in fact, I would take a day the week before school started and just have, like, a Tuesday or a Wednesday be a school day. And we would just wake up, we'd have our breakfast, I would drive him to school, we'd park the car, we'd get out, we'd walk to his room, and so on. So he really had the complete experience of what it was going to be like. And that really helped him.
Okay, so normalcy, What's on the docket? What's a third thing we can do to make this less stressful?
The third thing is if you perceive your child as having true, you know, concerns and anxiety around it, if you can address their sticking point. And for me, this third idea is the notion of sticking points, that sometimes people have something they get stuck on, and then they ruminate on it, they're concerned about it, and then they get afraid of it, and then they're afraid to admit they're afraid. So it's not necessarily the first thing out of the child's mouth. But if you can, through discussion of normalcy and through discussion of the docket, and watching their nonverbal behavior, perceive when their face, on their face, they seem concerned or stressed. You can go back to that and say, now, you know, sometimes when you get on the bus, that can be a concern for people. How do you picture yourself getting on the bus? What do you think might happen there? And let them describe it to you, and then they'll tell you, well, I'm afraid no one will talk to me, or what do I do if there's no place to sit? So they have some concerns about whatever this thing is. I'm using the example of a bus, but it might not be the bus. It could be something else entirely. But whatever their concern is, if you can locate it, then you can address it. And you can address it through various strategies, but the real key for the parent is not to jump in and assume they know what the problem is, but rather to let the child talk to them and to say to the child, well, what do you picture happening? What is the worst thing that could happen? That's always a good question to ask your child. What is the worst thing that can happen? Because then they're going to tell you what their fear is. And then instead of dismissing it by saying, oh, that'll never happen, don't do that. Better would be to say, well, what if that would happen? What could you say? What could you do? What would be a good thing to say or do? And then work with them, strategize, so they have a plan for what to do if the worst thing happens. And that might be role-playing. You know, we did that a lot with our kids if they had any concerns. But it can also just be saying, well, there might be many things that could be done there. Let's brainstorm a few ideas. Now, the real plus of this strategy I'm describing is not only does it address whatever your child's sticking point is right now, but it teaches them, if you do this over and over whenever there's a problem with your child, it teaches your child a methodology for how to address concerns in life, that you don't have to ever let a fear defeat you, but rather you face it head on and say, well, what do I think is the worst thing that can happen? And then ask yourself, what will I do if that happens? A brainstorm solution. Now, the real plus of this strategy I'm describing is not only does it address whatever your child's sticking point is right now, but it teaches them, if you do this over and over whenever there's a problem with your child, it teaches your child a methodology for how to address concerns in life, that you don't have to ever let a fear defeat you, but rather you face it head on and say, well, what do I think is the worst thing that can happen? And then ask yourself, what will I do if that happens? A brainstorm solution.
I remember when I was moving into fifth grade, I was going from a small rural school that had six grades in four rooms, and we were being consolidated going into the bigger school that had five separate fifth grade rooms.
Wow.
I was scared. Now I realize I was scared because I thought I wasn't going to be sophisticated enough to go to what we thought was the big mm-hmm. city school. But I don't know if I knew that's what it was at the time. What if you can't identify as a 10 or 11-year-old what maybe that fear is?
Well, you can say as the parent, well, what do you picture happening? Mm-hmm. What's going on in the room? What are you doing? What are the other children doing? What is the teacher doing? And through if you can get your child to talk about it, they will tell you what the problem is. Now, they may not use the language that an adult would use, but they could say something like, well, I sit in the wrong seat, and then everybody laughs at me. And then the teacher asks a question, I raise my hand, and I give what I think is the answer, but it turns out I'm wrong, and I get called out for being wrong, and everybody laughs at me again. Something like that, which would be a child's vision of probably not being sophisticated enough bad things that would happen. Or we're told to get out our books, and I get out the wrong book, and somebody elbows me, and it hurts because I got out the wrong book. So, you know, if a child could describe this and the parent can say, okay, well, what if you get out the wrong book? Then what's going to happen? What is the worst thing that's going to happen? And then they might say, well, I couldn't follow. And say, well, okay, well, if you can't follow, then you would probably figure out you have the wrong book. So what would be the next thing a person could do? And just kind of work through them, because, I mean, everybody now again pulls out the wrong book. So,
right.
You know, so what would be a good strategy for addressing that? So, again, just to teach your child, really, problem-solving skills, which are good through all of life at every age, of how to address whatever is their sticking point.
Is it a good idea, even if you don't suspect you have a child that might be anxious or nervous about the school year, to just at least ask them about the upcoming year? Or should Or if you don't suspect it, should you just let sleeping dogs lie?
Well, you can do either. You know, most parents know their child pretty well, so they can see how their child is behaving. Like if a child suddenly gets very quiet that last week, they might be worried about something. You know, when you see a change in behavior, no matter what it is, if they're acting out more or whatever, sleeping in more, it might be that they're anxious about something, so then you could address it. Like a lot of parents tell me they have a problem getting their children to talk to them. You know, how'd your day go? It was fine. You know, that kind of thing. Right. Like they never want to say anything. So it's good to develop as a parent three or four or five questions that you ask your kids every day about school, every day. So they anticipate these questions, and it gets to be fun. And you can ask them, like, when you pick them up in the car, so it's a good car conversation, or you can ask them at the dinner table, and then the whole family can have fun. But either way, and there's things like, okay, come on, tell me, Dish, what is the most interesting thing that happened today at school? Like, what was the cool thing, the unexpected thing, the crazy thing? And so if you ask those questions, you're going to get some really cute answers. Like, you're going to find out pretty regularly who gets sent to the principal, for example. And one of the wildest things that happened at recess, you're going to hear all about those. So you're going to feel like you're attending to school with your kid. You know, you're going to get, like, the scoop and the skinny. You know, it's kind of fun. But then as you wind down these questions, you can say, so what was the best thing that happened to you at school today? And they'll tell you. And then what is the worst thing that happened today that you wish, ooh, I wish it hadn't gone like that? And then let them tell you. And then you know what it is you need to address, because it's their telling you, in my opinion, this is the worst thing that happened to me today.
Lynn Webb is a professor of communications at the University of Arkansas. She discussed three things parents can do to help children ease into a new school year. If there's a three things subject you'd like to hear about, let us know. You can email us by sending an email to ozarksatlarge@gmail.com.
Just about everything we wear, eat, or consume is transported in huge containers on enormous ships. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with journalist Rose George about an invisible and sometimes exploitative part of the shipping world. And Grayson Schaefer tells us about the Sherpas on Mount Everest who risk injury or death helping people climb. Join us.
Fresh Air tonight at 6 on KUAF 91.3 FM.
Tomorrow, downtown Bentonville will again turn itself over to artists of almost every stripe. The third Thursday of each month is dedicated to bringing artists and art lovers together to mingle, discuss, and celebrate art. Tomorrow's edition of what is called Around the Block will include Zeke Taylor's artwork displayed at the Norberta Philbrook Gallery in downtown Bentonville. Zeke, who lives in Eureka Springs, has many admirers of his art that often includes chimps and other animals. This morning, we invited Zeke Taylor to come to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to talk about his show at the gallery. And we also asked Nikki Dallison with downtown Bentonville to come along to discuss the city's ongoing effort to make art part of the everyday experience. I began the conversation by asking Zeke about what he does when he's asked to be the featured artist for an exhibition.
I start painting. I try to have some new work at each opening event like that. And so I will go home and finish a painting today.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I mean, I have this image of, you know, painters just with works ready to go and you're waiting for the phone to ring.
Lucky for me, I'm very low on inventory, so I'm busy getting new works available. So always good to have new works at an event like that, and it's also a good time for the artist to interact with the public.
So you're finishing one up today. This is Wednesday. It will be hanging Thursday?
It will be hanging Thursday, yes.
But what happens if the one you're working on today, you step back and go, maybe not?
It will not be in the show.
Okay.
I have to like the painting in order to put it out there.
But I guess when you're at this stage, you're pretty sure that you're going to like it.
Yes. It's almost finished, and I do like it. So I think it will be in the show.
Does it have a title?
It has a title. It's a small painting with a frog in it, and it's called The Visitor.
So when people see The Visitor at the Philbrook Gallery, they'll know that this one, I mean, the paint is barely dry.
Barely dry, correct.
They may actually be able to watch the paint dry.
They might, yes.
Nikki, part of the whole idea behind Around the Block is to get artists like Zeke and people who appreciate art or are curious about art together, right?
Yes, that's correct. We're very appreciative of the gallery openings. We have Zeke at Norberta Philbrook. We have Yarnography at Press Room, which is a very amazing show.
With a Eureka Springs connection there.
Yes, that's correct. 21C Museum is doing their curated tours on Thursday. And Dayton Castleman has an open studio with the progress viewing of the Art Center of the Ozarks.
Oh, his exhibit called Coin.
Yes.
And it's a lot of cardboard, is that correct?
I believe so.
Yeah. Zeke, do you like interacting with people?
I love interacting with people. And if someone does purchase my work, I love knowing the people that's going home with.
What do you ever eavesdrop if there are a couple of people looking at a work of yours and they don't know you're the artist?
Yes, and sometimes it can be really fun, especially if they have negative comments about it. But I don't let them know that I'm the artist of that.
You just let them go on.
I let them go on, yes. Most of the time the comments are positive, and I'm basically pretty shy, however, so it's a little bit hard to accept praise, but I know that's part of the biz, being there. And people do like to meet the artist.
Right. You've lived in Northwest Arkansas since the
1975.
Safe to say there are more places for art to be seen now than then?
Yes, yes. All over Northwest Arkansas, from Eureka to Bentonville. And we have a great connection between Bentonville and Eureka Springs arts community. We're working together, promoting each other, and really helping each other. When we work together, we elevate each other. So the number of galleries is phenomenal compared to what it was in 1975. Eureka Springs has the largest number of galleries in the state.
And that's not per capita. That's just
in the state, yes.
Yeah,
and Bentonville's gallery scene is constantly growing. And the quality of the galleries is really up there.
Nikki, I know that it's been part of downtown Bentonville. Part of the mantra, it seems, this year and in the past couple of years has been get art in the public.
Yes.
Public art. Have it be part of the everyday experience.
Right. That's correct. We really want to open up the waves for community art and making art accessible to everyone who enjoys it. Part of what we're doing at Around the Block is the Artist Alleyway, where we like to have artists come showcase. People can view their work, purchase their work. Right now, this time, we have everything from concrete art, jewelry, clothing, and it's going to be really fun. We have a guy that does paintings out of Bella Vista, and his paintings are all focused on downtown. So that's going to be really neat to see.
Zeke, I want to ask you about animals, because you love to put animals in your art.
Yes.
Has that always been the case?
I grew up an animal lover, so yes, it has always been the case. It's my favorite subject matter.
And sometimes you give a bit of personification to the animals?
I do. The first chimp painting I did was an assignment for a decorator pillow company that was carrying my work nationwide, and they would use my designs on the pillow tops. And they wanted a clothed chimp, and it was so much fun and got such great response that I continued to do those. And people now collect them, so
yes,
that's
do.
Another reason to keep doing them.
Nothing wrong with that.
Right.
And so the one that is in progress, the visitor you mentioned has a frog.
Right. And I just finished one with the lizard. Before that, I did do an iris painting, so they're not all animals.
Are there any animals that you haven't put in a work yet that you're thinking, okay, there's a platypus?
A platypus might be fun. I've recently started doing dogs, which I've sort of avoided doing, but I've been receiving commissions to do dog portraits. And so that is a new animal to me that I'm using in my work.
Are there, again, forgive me if this is a pedestrian question, are there animals that are harder to do than other animals?
Yes, and partly depends on color.
Ah.
A black cat or black dog or a white cat or white dog is much harder to do than one with some color or pattern in it, just because of the shading.
Wow. That seems counterintuitive to me. I would think that I thought you were going to say a black cat would be the easiest, just because you throw on.
Yeah, but you have to use shading in it to give it shape, and so there's got to be various degrees of depth in that black in order to give the cat form or the dog. And the same thing with white. A white animal, to shade, it's going to have some color to it, even though it's white.
Hmm.
So those are always a challenge.
But then, say, a calico cat would be?
Easier, because there's pattern and depth in the color that's already there.
Thank you both.
Thank you, Kyle.
Thank you.
Zeke Taylor and Nikki Dallison came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio earlier today to talk about tomorrow's Around the Block event in Bentonville. You can learn more about Zeke and see some of his artwork, some that perhaps is not even done yet, at his website, ZekeTaylor.com. That's ZeekTaylor.com. You can learn much more about Around the Block at downtownbentonville.org. This is Ozarks at Large.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. The Beaver Water District presents the 8th Annual Secchi Day, Saturday, August 17th, from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Prairie Creek on Beaver Lake. The Science Education Festival offers activities for all ages, including a mobile aquarium, scavenger hunt, lunch, pontoon boat rides, and more. Information available at 717-3807 or on the web at bwdh20.org.
The KUAF website giveaway is offering event passes to the Fayetteville Roots Festival that takes place August 22nd through the 25th. That's next week. One winner will receive 2 4-day passes. Those passes include Friends of the Festival backstage concert, late-night passes, plus the Roots Festival main stage. The drawing will be Friday during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. You can still register. Registration and information available at KUAF.com.
A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas, this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Centerton.
Centerton, right there in the middle of Benton County,
yep.
Hence the name. A couple of music notes that I want to pass along.
Sure.
Walton Arts Center announced this morning, big announcement.
I saw.
Willie Nelson and family coming to Northwest Arkansas.
I know some people are going to be very excited about that.
Well, I know a lot of people. The concert itself is Tuesday, November 26th at 7 p.m. Tickets will go on sale Friday morning at 9,
mm-hmm.
and they range from $49 to $79.
That seems okay, because I feel like...
It seems more than okay,
didn't
right?
Didn't he come through Springdale a few years back?
Yep.
And I feel like tickets were like closer to 100, but right. I think that had to do with like a table and maybe dinner
right.
as well.
Right. I know I saw him, I think in 81 or 82 at Barnhill Arena.
Did you really?
Yeah. I would suggest if you're thinking about going, seriously...
Get them quickly?
Yeah. I mean, that's 1,200 seats there in Walton Arts Center.
Okay, I know people talk about him around here often. I get confused. Maybe you can clear this up for me. Is he from here, or he just has?
He has connections here.
Okay.
He has connections here. He's a Texan.
Okay, that's what I thought. I thought he was from Texas, but I knew that people talk
here.
About him here often. So
yes.
I didn't know family or what it was.
Yes, he does like to come back here.
Okay,
and so this will be exciting. Also, want to tell you that the Titanic Museum in Branson, Missouri, uh-huh. is extending the exhibit they have of the Wallace Hartley violin. Wallace Hartley was the band leader on the Titanic, and as the Titanic went down, you know, the legend is that he played. Well, they say they think this is the violin that he would have been playing as the ship went down. You can learn more at TitanicBranson.com.
I remember that in the movie, but I didn't realize that was based on a legend or truth.
Yeah, I think it's legend. There's probably a Titanic expert out there that can tell me whether it's legend or truth. Yes.
Oh.
So that's at that museum up there.
In Branson. All right,
yes.
Cool.
Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Thanks so much for listening. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF.